closed. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang namang sangang namassami. This is a very rich collection, and I used to not even chant it with at the monastery, except it was just with the monastics, and I would skip over it for lay people. And then I started chanting it for lay people and inviting them to reflect for themselves which ones are appropriate for them. And so I got a lot of fair bit of feedback that people really like these. And sometimes, as I say, it may not be overtly part of the layperson's life, but it is symbolically and in some ways sometimes I tell lay people that you're all monks and nuns, that you just don't know it. You don't own anything. So monks don't own anything, and you don't own anything either. Nobody owns anything. But there's a kind of a hallucination going around that we own something, that we have things, that we... So the Buddha asked the monks to give things up and renounce things, even though he says you can't own anything anyway. So why does he ask the monks to do this? It's just so that the outwardly, it looks like they gave stuff up because people still believe that they have stuff. So the monks, wow, those guys gave it up. The monks are saying, you don't have anything anyway. You never did. And you'll find out at the end of your life that you never did have anything. And of course, as you're going through life, sometimes things, you lose things, they're stolen from you, they break something, and you find out that you didn't ultimately own it because you couldn't control it, so you didn't own it. But I'm getting ahead of myself, so let's start out at the beginning. Also, to notice that the teachings of the Buddha are in a nice grouping so that they're for the sake of memory. They didn't have the luxury of handing out sheets at the time of the Buddha. They had to just recite 10 things, so 10 is a good upper number for remembering things. I am no longer living according to worldly aims and values. And this, for one who goes forth, you know, some, it depends on the motivations that you go forth with. Not everybody goes forth with the same motivations. They don't understand what this is all about. They think it's a nice lifestyle, or their family thinks it's a good idea, or they have misguided notions about what that lifestyle might involve. So they don't understand that they are giving up their worldly aims and values. So they fall back and start to manifest these type of preoccupations. And they have to undo this again and again. So this could be, you know, you might have to undo that 10 times a day or more every day for years even, until it becomes second nature that you just don't have those worldly aims and values. Others go into the robes, they've already, they just lost their worldly aims and values. There is no other place for them. That could be that definitely is the case for the last stage of enlightenment. What can be attained as a layperson. So the arahant, you can attain arahantship as a layperson. I'm going to pause here because somebody may listen to this recording, and I'm making a dramatic pause because there's all kinds of people who read that and know there's another little thing, and they're already saying that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. But then I'm going to say, within 6 to 7 days, the arahant enters the robes. So that's the clause on the end. You can attain arahantship, final stage of enlightenment, as a layperson, but you will enter the robes within 7 days. You will give up the household life, enter it. You can't live as a layperson anymore. Or, failing to enter the robes, you will die. I want to explain that as well, because it's very often misunderstood. if you don't get into the robes in 7 days, you're going to die. That's a curse. Like, no, that's not what happens. It's that if you died in 7 days, of course, you wouldn't get into the robes, would you? So 7 days. And I presume that basically you're headed for the robes in 7 days. You might not be able to arrange an ordination in 7 days. You know, you're basically out of there. The only possible lifestyle for you is the monastic one. Now, that's the arahant. This is the final stage of enlightenment. And so they would enter without any worldly aims and values. They would enter absolutely purely into the monastic life. They would already be, in a sense, a monk or nun in all but the outer signs. All the other three stages of enlightenment, so we have the first stage is called sotapanna or stream entry. Second stage, sakadagami, once returner. Third stage is called anagami, non-returner. And the fourth stage is called arahant, one who is finished. And the first three stages, people can enter in the first three stages, or they can remain in the household life, right up to the anagami. When you're an anagami, a non-returner, you are basically finished with the sensory world and the all worldly ambitions. You don't have a trace left. You're in the household life only because there's some karmic tangle there. You have some, perhaps your parents are very old and you're the only one that can look after them or something like that. Something is impedes you from just walking out the door into the holy life, but you behave as a monk or a nun. You are now automatically also celibate. You don't have any interest, sexual interest left. Done. You don't have any interest in money, praise, fame, any of these things. You're no longer interested. You're at peace, profound peace, and whenever you get a moment, you basically go into jhana. But it's still functional. You can do things that you need to do, but you're not doing anything frivolously or for any other things, reasons. But it is interesting that you could be at that advanced stage and still be not a monastic, but it would depend on these extra circumstances. The other two stages, still it's possible in the first and second stage of enlightenment to have some worldly attachments. You could have some reactive emotions, anger and desire. You might have a little bit of ego as well. But they're very limited, and they have limits as to how far you can go with any of them. So anybody short of that who enters the monastic life would still have at some level the fetters, the things which cause you to be worldly, have worldly aims and values. And so the monks and nuns are, most of them would be worldlings. Putujana is a nice word for it, a worldling, putujana, aspiring to freedom. And so they would have to reflect quite often, regularly, that this is, I'm not in the world anymore. I don't work by those motives anymore. So it's a very important recollection. But it's not just for monks and nuns either. It can be for a lay, the householder as well, to reflect, well, so how much is this motivating me anymore? How much are my worldly aims and values, how important is this stuff to me anymore? How much is it motivating me, driving me? And even for the lay person who's sincere, they need to recognize the conflict between strong attachments and ambitions and freedom, ease, contentment. You know, sometimes we get a little confused about how much ambition and so forth contributes to our livelihood and so forth. We say, well, you know, I'm a layperson. I don't go on alms round. I need some money. I have to buy things and so forth. So I can't just give up my motivations. I have to go and be motivated. Sometimes we get confused about that. Quite often, it's not about motivation. We think we have to be highly motivated, but basically, often it's more a matter of just showing up to do your job. And we add a lot to it, an unnecessary amount of tension and stress to it. And we think magically that somehow that stress and tension is why we're succeeding in it, but you might find out that you could actually, if you lose your ambition and so forth, you can do it just as well, but you just don't have that inner tension anymore. My very life is sustained through the gifts of others. And some, I think that's a beautiful reflection, certainly for monks. The Buddha deliberately puts us in this role of dependency. He does not want us to be, so in the Christian monasteries, they work, they have livelihoods, they earn their keep for the monastery, they share, they have communal property, and they can work very hard. The Benedictine motto is work and prayer. So they can be working 7-8 hours a day and so forth, and they're manufacturing things, selling things through the monastery. They don't have personal possessions, so they manage to get some detachment that way. But the Buddha, for us, does not permit us to make a livelihood except by our livelihood is as alms mendicant. You need to receive your food every day from a non-monastic, some lay person gives you food. And you don't buy it, and you don't store it. It expires at noon. And tomorrow, somebody will have to give you some food again. And it's just one day at a time. The Buddha very, very emphatically and with lots of rules makes sure you live that way and that you never can be secure. The security is an illusion, isn't it? So we're dependent, and we have to remember we're dependent on the gifts of others. So there's a certain level of gratitude for that. People offer us these robes, the food, and if transportation, if I have to go anywhere that I need transportation, it has to be offered. Medicine as well. The basics all have to be offered. And it's interesting, you come out of it's not like monks are unfortunate people that never had any money and so they had to go into the robes. And quite often they come from fairly successful backgrounds and so forth. They just renounce all that. Now it's a very interesting experience to be a alms mendicant. Walk through, you know, in Thailand, even in the U.S., the monks in White Salmon near Portland, they go alms round 5 days a week through the little town nearby. It's 2,000 people in the town. It's called White Salmon. They go. I was just down there. I went on alms round. We walked down the street with bowls and robes, and the certain people in the town invite us to come to their house, and we knock on the door, and somebody comes to the door and puts food in your bowl. And some of these people are very interesting. Some of them are not Buddhist even, and they've never gone to the monastery. They just like the idea of giving somebody some food. This is a little old lady that just made some great cookies. And every Monday you go there, and she's just so happy to see you. Not a Buddhist, doesn't know anything about it, just loves to see you. She's nice cookies. And I said to her, can we give you a blessing? And she said, yes, give me a blessing. I need it. My grandkids are coming. I'm going to be cooking. I got a bad hip. My grandkids are going to be here 3-4 days. I'm going to be doing nothing but cooking. I need a blessing. So we chanted to her in Pali, and she's just like having a shower. You know, so. Oh, yeah, that feels so good. So. Thank you. Have a nice day. The next door we come to, knock, knock, a little girl in underpants comes and opens the door. And then her mother shows up and her dad and so forth, and then her little brother and so forth. And so they're all standing there looking at us and kids, and we're having a little chat. And then they go and get the food, and they get the kids to, oh yeah, feed the monks and so forth. So it's like, it's real fun. They just love it, you know. And this has been going on for years now. In Asia, we just basically can walk anonymously down the street at a reasonable time in the morning, and you will not get a block, and somebody will come out of their house that you've never seen in your life and feed you. And that happens anywhere in Thailand, in Burma, in Sri Lanka. Strangely enough, I've been in other countries as well, like Mexico, where they have a residual Catholic tradition where they still remember what monks are and nuns are. And you can walk down there in your robes, and these Mexican villagers will just come out of their house. Who are you? What are you doing? Oh, we're hoping to get fed. They rush back and get food and put it in your bowl. And there's just like in the psyche. Yeah, in the psyche. I've also been on alms around in Winchester, Virginia. That's where, who's that country singer? Patsy Cline Boulevard. She's from Winchester, Virginia. They got Patsy Cline Boulevard. Anyway, there's a monastery near there, the Bhavana Society, and once a week we go to Winchester and down through the middle of Winchester in the mall. First time down, there's a Virginia State Trooper standing in the middle of the mall. And so we walk down this kind of shopping area. It's closed off to cars. Cop comes out, and we can see him a long ways away standing in the middle of the road. We're a mile line. He says, so what's going on here? And we say, well, we're Buddhist monks, and we're on alms round. This is one of our traditions, and we don't ask for food, but if people volunteer to feed us, then it's fine. He says, wait here. Runs into a sandwich shop, buys a few sandwiches, puts it in our bowl. Have a nice day. Great. So it's quite a touching experience to be on the other end of it all, you know. You're not in a power relationship where you give things away. You voluntarily agreed to be in a permanent state of dependency. Strangely, it's as a kind of like that simile of grass, that the grass bends in the wind and the trees break in the wind. You know, it's like just you stay low and humble. And that tradition has lasted 2,600 years, while all the great empires of the world have risen and fallen. None of them have lasted more than 600 or 700 years. So one way to reflect in the household life as well, the beauty of being a recipient. Now, some people have trouble receiving gifts. Some people have trouble giving gifts. Some people have trouble receiving it. Some people like to receive gifts, but they have trouble giving gifts. Some people like to give gifts, but they have trouble receiving gifts. And one should practice both. It's like to be to enjoy receiving things, like drop it, you know, and also to enjoy giving things, to be able to do both, you know. Just open yourself up. You're providing some joy to another person to be able to receive things. And so this is a skill that one should work with, and recognize also and appreciate that humans are not like animals. We don't know much when we're born, and we won't know much until we're about 20 or 25. And, you know, those 25 years, everything is completely dependent on somebody else's knowledge, skills, advice. We're completely helpless recipients of training and knowledge from everybody else. We're not independent. We didn't figure it out ourselves. We can't. Occasionally there are children who are abandoned, you know, left with the wolves or whatever, but they All they know is to be a little bit of a wolf, you know. So we are, everything we have is a gift from others. The first, and if we don't get those gifts in the first part of life, we have great deficits. So it is the nature of human community that we are interdependent, we are dependent, we're not independent. And it's a kind of a false illusion to strive for that sort of independence. The independent spirit is an illusion. You need all kinds of information and help from all kinds of other humans. So we not place that value so high. We should place our value higher on reflection that will come later, which I'll talk about when we talk about independence. I should strive to abandon my former habits, and of course those habits are negative habits. It doesn't say specifically negative habits or worldly habits, but that's what they mean, is that habit structures are profound, and it's amazing, you know, when you become a monk, you just realize what you're loaded with, and it's just, you identify with your habits. And it's just you, and couldn't it wait till next week, or maybe when I get to my fifth reign, I'm sure I'll be there. Like, it's hard to confront habit power, but that's what he's asking you to do. He says, have you abandoned your habits? He wouldn't be asking that if you couldn't, or that if he thought you couldn't. And some people believe they can't, but he says you can abandon your former habits. You can, again, it can be a struggle of tension, but eventually it becomes second nature. There are things that I had struggled with in the beginning of my practice, which are now, I don't even remember what it was. It's now second nature. It's gone. There's no tension in it. There's no, sometimes people ask me, one of our stewards is named Delaney, and she's a Sri Lankan Canadian. She's born and raised in Canada, but from a Buddhist family. She's one of the stewards and she has various friends and a cousin as well, who's also Sri Lankan, but she's Christian, and quite a convinced Christian. And she has a buddy who's maybe Jewish, but not very convinced Jewish, but a bit of a philosopher. So she had them visit the monastery, and she said, "You should go and talk to the monks." So we came in, and they interrogated me about my lifestyle. And like I told them, yeah, well, you know, no family, no intimacy, no booze, no music. And I said, you know, I used to be a musician. That was how I was a professional musician. I was trained as a classical musician, a master's degree in classical guitar performance and so forth. And she said, "You used to?" "Yeah, monks don't play music, and then we don't listen to music either." "Whoa, what's, how do you?" So no deficit there. I don't miss it. There's nothing to it. And they were saying, "Whoa, it's, you know, like says iron will, or it's like an Olympic sport where you see what you can do without for this, who can last longest." And I was saying, no, there's no sense at all of any deprivation. Renunciation, the word renunciation, is not about some grim giving up against your will, but is just unburdening, freedom, you know, letting go of things that weigh a lot. And so these habit structures can fall away and not... You're not in any conflict with it at all, so you feel free, light, don't miss it. It's possible. And it's well worth it. Doesn't matter how long it takes. What else have you got to do in life than get free? I mean, really, what else do you have to do? Everything else is secondary. It's you know, you have to have some food on the table and so forth, but what's all that for? What's it to support? It is this aspiration to freedom. Freedom from what? The unnecessary distress, trouble, emotional friction within you. This should not be. You don't have to live that way. That's your main goal. is to free yourself from that. Just lighten and free yourself from that. Does regret over my conduct arise in my mind? If you have remorse, then you think before you do anything. You think, before I do this, is this wholesome? Is this skillful? While you're doing it, is this wholesome? Is this skillful? And afterwards, was that wholesome? Was that skillful? Three stages: before, during, after. And if regret rises in your mind, then you have to say, thank you very much. This remorse is telling me something. I don't like remorse. I don't like guilt. In fact, I will try to let go of this remorse and guilt. It's not part of the Buddhist teaching to appreciate guilt or to feel that there's no benefit in feeling the guilt or wallowing in the guilt, but there is a great deal of benefit in trying to live more skillfully so that such things do not arise. Such remorse over your actions do not arise. So you have two things to do. One is that, so things that you have done because you were unskillful, that you regret, let that go and concentrate on the present and the future, being more skillful, and so that you don't have to be letting things go, because sometimes it's very sticky. The remorse and the guilt is hard to let go of. By all means, do let go of it, but when it comes up, say, thank you very much. I know you're just reminding me to be more careful in the future. And that's really the way to do it. It's thank you very much. Goodbye for now. I heard you the first time. You know, all night long, the guilt, I've guilted you. So, could my spiritual companions find fault with my conduct? This is nice to have a peer group. No, not could anybody find fault with my conduct. The foolish can often find fault with your conduct, but there is no fault. So could my spiritual companions find fault with my conduct? That's your peer group. That's very important to be concerned with their opinions and think, you know, is this okay, or they really find fault with that? It's a very important voice in your mind to help you. That's the external voice that is helpful to you. There's an internal voice that's your sense of what we call the two guardians of the world, Hiri and Otapa. Hiri and Otapa is sometimes translated as fear and a sense of shame. So a sense of shame is to do with how do others regard this action. Fear is a wholesome fear for your own safety and well-being. Don't do dangerous things, stupid things that will endanger your own happiness. You need that faculty. And even if nobody else is ever going to know about it, you will know about it. And you need to nurture that fear for your own safety. Regarding the future, it's not about being afraid of anything. It's about wisely afraid of self-injury. Don't stand too close to the edge of that cliff. There's a reason why you have a fear of, you know, stay back. That's a good thing. It's not that you're swept with fear and trembling. It's just that you need to have love for yourself, and that love translates into you have a fear of damaging your loved ones, and that's you and others. And they also have good, high regard for your safety and well-being, and that's why they would say to you that what you just did is not a good idea. It's injurious to yourself or others. And so that voice is very nice. They say that because they care about you. So it is, spiritually speaking, it's good to have a peer group that you have some regard for their opinions. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. That's so important to just make that real, that This is the famous question. We were at tea time, the monastery, I bring it up every now and then. People come and they've just gotten out of a relationship or been booted out of a relationship or dragged out of a relationship or things, or they're in a relationship that it keeps falling apart, getting back together, or it should have fallen apart a long time ago. It's just a matter of time, or is it? When is it over? And so the plaintive question, how do you know when a relationship's over? So if you understand this reflection, you will know the answer to that. The answer is when it starts. All relationships end. All that I have, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. Relationship to your dearest and nearest, humans, animals, objects, all, and your own body as well. That's the facts. And at first it's just, you just don't want to hear it. You don't want to know about it. But it's liberating to... Now, when you reflect on these truths, you don't just plunge your face into it. You don't just face it, and it gives you the willies, makes you sad. That's not the way to contemplate these things. The Buddha says, don't bring up these negative images, negative emotions. Calm yourself down. Make yourself feel better, clearer, calmer. And when you're in a serene and lucid mood, bring up these truths and look at them. When your mind is receptive to them and not distorted by fear or regret or grief, look at them. And if you feel it, that you're starting to lose it, that you're getting off the away from lucidity and balance, and you're drifting into fear and grief, then stop and put it aside. Go back to some positive things that ground you, like loving kindness and so forth, breath meditation, equanimity. Get some distance and clarity. And then when you're again lucid and clear, bring up these truths in clarity and in serenity. Because some of them are very hard. The death is hard, loss is hard, aging is hard, illness is hard, the fragility of the body is hard, the uncertainty of life is hard. But they need to be looked at, they need to be brought into your operating system, but they need to be brought in without fear and horror and grief and so forth. This is not the mode that is beneficial. I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do for good or ill, of that I will be the heir. That's really the key to meaning in your life, is that whatever I do is meaningful. It means something. If I do something unskillful, it has consequences. And that's, if there weren't any consequences, life is meaningless. It's just random. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury and signifying nothing. That's what Shakespeare says about meaningless life. No consequences, no resultants, no connection between events. But the Buddha is saying, if you want to be well and happy and peaceful and have basically core life vitality, you have to commit yourself to the sense of meaning that everything you do has consequences, will not be lost. Everything you do negatively and positively. And the resultants of negative things, you'll have to face that with courage and with equanimity. You don't have to feel guilty about it. You don't have to think, I wish I hadn't done that. You don't have to think, why was I so stupid? It wasn't you, it was your younger sister or your younger brother. It was you when you were stupid. Otherwise you wouldn't be saying, why did I do that? You'd be saying, glad I did that. So, you know, if you have objections to what you did, then you're already different and wiser, and you're not the one who did it. So don't be guilty, it's that one who did it. And they didn't, you have a lot of insight into them. They just didn't know any better. So don't just drop the guilt. It's useless. It was somebody else. And you won't have to pay for it, but your older brother will. That credit card spree, it's good that you don't have to pay for it, but your older brother, sorry about that. Somebody's going to have to pay for this. And I trust that that person will be wise and brave and understanding when they receive the bill. And that's the way to think about it. The days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? It's very important. It's time just slips away, and we're frittering away our time, and we didn't meditate, and we didn't think, and we didn't reflect, and we're off diddling around with that and diddling around with that and days I've gotta get moving here. It's getting fat. After 40, breakfast comes every 15 minutes. You have to motivate yourself. Do I delight in solitude or not? This is a very profound question for monks. I just finished a year of solitude, and now Ajahn Siddhanta, he's the abbot of the Pacific Hermitage, is doing his turn as a year of solitude. And partly because I did a year of solitude, and that's what the Buddha says, you know, make sure monks, senior monks, please go into solitude so that junior monks will also know about solitude. And so I said, yes, boss, I will go into solitude. It's part of my job description. It's not always easy to, especially in the West, we have these monasteries and they require a great deal of organization and people power and all kinds of stuff. It's not a free ride. Like in Asia, everybody understands, they just support it because it's a great idea, it's meritorious and so forth. It's without expectation. But in the West, we're still moving towards that idea, but I try to push it along a little bit, just like you realize that a monk going into solitude is a good thing. It's just a good idea. And that the monastery hopefully is still supported, is still standing when you come out, hopefully. And so these things have to be, we have to take chances with that and just do it. And it turned out quite well. It is the monastery is still standing, and but it's an experiment, and so solitude is an important aspect of human life, and this is what I mean by independence. Is like, how are you when you're alone? Are you happy? Do you delight in it? If not, the Buddha says you need to work on that. Solitude is not something that you should be averse to or afraid of. Solitude is something to cultivate and to learn to enjoy. And that, if that word holiness is the old English spelling of W-H-O-L-E. They're just pronouncing it holy. They pronounce the A, the E on the end. So whole is complete. What is it? To be complete is not to miss anything. It's to be complete in your own company at ease. And so we have to work on that. We have to work on that. Everybody needs to work on that. Has my practice borne fruit with freedom or insight so that at the end of my life I need not feel ashamed when questioned by my spiritual companions? There's the reflection on death and how did I spend my time wisely? And I do have this peer group that is meaningful to me right to death. And it's meaningful that I spent my life wisely in their eyes as well. So we're not just dismissing all people's opinion. We're in a relationship with others. It's very important. There's a heart relationship. We have been inspired by those who have virtue, have walked upright, and we want to be inspiring to them, to others as well. And it should be on our mind. So how did I spend my life? You know, I will have to answer to my friends. Not to. We don't have this idea of God. You know, don't judge by God. You're friends. You're gonna say, you know. Basically, I peed away 30 years, you know. Or, no, I made good use of the time, my friends. It's worth it. It's worth it. Whatever it takes, do it. So that's the 10 subjects for frequent recollection by one who has gone forth. And you can see in your own lay life how you could possibly use those.